Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Black Techies Podcast, brought to you by HBCU Digital Network. I am your host, Herbert Seward. And as you can see today, we are doing a duo, and we have the illustrious host emeritus with us, the original founder of the Black Techies, David Matthews, a.k.a. Packet Stealer. First, welcome back. It's been a minute since you've been on the podcast in the host capacity. You know,
I know, right? I've had a lot of family time every weekend, so I never really had a chance. But I asked my wife, can I be on the podcast? And she was like, all right. So I got the wife's permission.
Yeah, so for those of you guys out there watching, the last couple of shows we've been doing, we've been using a different intro into our show. And that intro is advertising a book project that myself and Dave were also a part of, you know, the first edition of the book, the HBCU Experience Band Alumni Edition. Now, this second edition has some pretty heavy hitters on it for those of you guys that are familiar with the band world and familiar with the culture. The first edition was literally an Amazon bestseller, and this one looks like it's going to exceed that. So for those of you guys out there following, that follow the culture, that follow HBCU marching bands, the whole nine, do not hesitate to pick up the book. The authors, I think there are maybe five or six more authors than there were in the first edition. And they all have some really amazing stories. So if you're out there in those Amazon streets online and you're looking to pick up something to read, check out the second edition of the HBCU Experience, HBCU Band Edition, second edition. You know, just mad props out to the second batch of authors that are part of this project. And man, we're looking forward to seeing those stories.
Definitely. It was great doing the first one. I mean, that's the first time I had ever contributed to a book like that. So it was kind of cool to see, not only share my own story, but to kind of see everyone else's stories and just read about them.
Yeah. And the fact that you get a contributing author, you know, quotation.
add that to my CV.
Yes, that's a pretty dope thing. I know, speaking for myself, you know, doing content creation and writing, you know, for some other platforms, you know, in the HBCU sports and culture space, you know, that kind of raises an eyebrow sometimes. It's like, oh, you wrote on this? Like, yes, that was me. So, right. You know, those sorts of things are really, really cool. And, you know, the fact that we got a second book coming out with a whole batch of new authors is really exciting to see. That being said, we are going to get into the meat of our show. And where should we start? Twitter. Twitter.
Our boy
Elon Musk is flaking out on this deal as predicted. You know, the shiny new thing for him is not shiny anymore, and he is planning to renege on the deal to buy Twitter. But Twitter is not going to go quietly into the night upon this change, a reversal of, you know, a fortune for this deal. And they are going to be taking litigation to make sure that, you know, Elon, you know, forks up the cash and stays, you know, within the legal confines of the deal that he made. So, Dave, what do you think about this, man? Because I know we're all of us are on the space. You know, I use the space a lot these days, you know, to really market. For us, we market the podcast. You know, a lot of our digital partners are in the space, you know, as just like everybody else. What do you get from that?
So it's funny because, like, you know, his original pitch was that, like, you know, I'm going to improve the service. I'm going to make it more, you know, free speech, you know, all of that and all those buzzwords that you see on the right. nowadays. And so it's, and he sold like a whole a bill of goods, right? And now it's like maybe he doesn't want to follow through. I feel like he was trolling just because, like, it's only something a rich guy could do, right? Like, only a rich person can be like, I'm going to buy Twitter for like billions of dollars and then try to, you know, go back on it. But yeah, like you said, Twitter's not going to let him do it. They're going to fight it in a Delaware court, which, from what I've heard from some people, that it's not looking good for Elon. It's not looking good for it, because I think Delaware is going like, nope, you said you was going to buy Twitter, you going to buy Twitter. Go ahead.
And I mean, I think that's the big thing for me. That's kind of, it's like, dude, come on, man. You're, you know, you're forking up $44 million to buy this platform. And the excuse that he came up with to back out of the platform, you know, there are too many spam accounts on the platform. It's like, come on, man.
There's, which is lame, I mean, because if you have Twitter literally gave him the database, showed him the database the entire, and they were like, no, look, we're bots aren't really that much of a problem, or we have them in control. So, I mean, and that wasn't part of the deal anyway, right? The deal was either Twitter or Elon had to pay $1 billion if one of them backed out. But his reasoning, so Twitter will only have to pay $1 billion if they backed out, and that will only be due to what their clause was, but it wasn't because of spam bots or anything like that. It was something very specific. So he doesn't really have a leg to stand on his accusations. So that's probably why he's going to lose, and he's going to have to end up buying Twitter, which, and you can also see why this is from a business perspective. I mean, you know, doing things for the good of the shareholders and creating value for the shareholders. That's the main reason why Twitter is doing this, because if he does this, the shareholders are going to be very rich. So
yeah,
they're trying to go through with this deal. So I don't know. I mean,
yeah. And the, you know, the fact that he's kind of flaking on this deal, you know, predictably has, you know, had a negative impact on Twitter stock. You know, Twitter stock has dropped immensely. I think it's like, you know, like, it, I mean, I know we looked at, I think it's like $5, $6, $7 a stock, as opposed to where he was going to buy it at, which was substantially higher. And right. It was just like, you know, that, you know, just doing stuff like that is damaging to the brand. Not the fact that people aren't going to invest in Twitter, that, you know, that ain't it. You know, Twitter is big enough, it's a pretty big enough platform right now that it's, you know, pretty much self-sustaining. But, you know, it's just the, you know, the stock damage that's going along with it. You know, it's a really stupid thing to see. And
the employees. I mean, imagine being an employee right now. Like, your company is going through this whole turmoil, and you're like, you're wondering, how is this going to affect my job? How is this going to affect like my well-being, my living situation? Like, I don't, like, is this gonna, like, what is going to be the fallout of this? And I can definitely see a lot of Twitter folks being a little antsy right now.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think, like I said, this is also the, you know, there's also a bit of a tie-in to that from people that were really looking forward to seeing, you know, a certain orange-haired, you know, former president being back on the platform, you know, because that, you know, people talk about that stuff, you know. I mean, to be quite honest with you, the day that dude got banned from the platform was was comic relief of epic proportions. And the fact that, you know, the people that were looking to Elon Musk to, you know, somehow miraculously resurrect, you know, the orange specter of Mango Mussolini on the platform was even funnier. You know, it's just, you know, it's those sorts of things that kind of tie into, you know, a lot of the angst that people were experiencing behind him possibly buying the platform and him kind of changing the rules, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? I mean, Yeah, anybody who's ever been on Twitter knows that Twitter can be a really hairy place on some, in talking about specific topics. Even if you're talking about very benign topics, you got troll. I mean, it's very, very much troll infested, like any place else these days. But I think, the most disingenuous thing about, seeing how Musk has kind of acted around purchasing the platform, then, parroting things about free speech about the platform, and then turning around and, just using a really lame reason to back out of the deal says a lot.
And the thing is,
It's
he could have investigated this before he even did anything. So like, let me read this right quick from The Verge. So all right, they said that Musk has been setting the stage to abandon the deal since just weeks after he signed the agreement, claiming that Twitter released misleading stats about the prevalence of spam bots on the platform. It's entirely unclear, however, that Musk can legally abandon his agreement simply because he isn't happy about the presence of spam on Twitter, something he could have investigated prior to signing the deal. So, like, so that combined with what you just said was like, because that was what everyone was afraid of, right? That if Elon owns Twitter, then Trump will get back on and all hell would break loose. It'll basically be pre 2020 again. So, or pre-election 2020, whenever they kicked them out. So let me say this, because some people are gonna hear this and they're going to, my conservative friends, like I'll even caveat that saying that I generally lean more conservative, right? You all know that. But at the same time, Twitter is a private company, right? Free speech does not apply to private companies unless it's specifically written in the law that you can't discriminate on someone based on whatever, right? On protected categories, right? But Twitter is a private company. And if they want to ban you based on their rules, that's their platform, right? The First Amendment only applies to the government, not private companies. So, I mean, you can get mad at Twitter all you want if they ban people that you don't think should be banned. But here's the thing about capitalism and the free market. Make your own, right? That's what happened, right? We got Truth Social, ironically, right? And Gab and all these other places, all these other apps popped up that, funnily enough, all got deplatformed by Amazon and all the ISPs.
No, no
That was
comment.
funny. Right, but so I mean I don't know what's going to happen exactly, because even if he is forced to buy the company, he's going to own it, then what, right? So I
Yeah.
this is just going to be messy. I don't know.
It's a, I mean, as somebody, for folks that use the platform, for folks that use the platform that have absolutely no interest in seeing what Elon Musk does or doesn't do with the platform. It sucks because it's like, if he buys it, people are going to be, have a lot of anxiety about, how he's going to handle the platform, who's going to be able to come back, who isn't. If he doesn't, and, this goes through, it damages the platform in that way because, shareholders are going to be kind of hot about the fact that A, the deal didn't go through and their pockets are empty. So, and I mean, it damages the long-term viability of the platform, just from a perception standpoint. And, it's really a lose-lose type of deal for the folks that, like ourselves, that really just frequent the platform to use it for whatever. If you're not in a stock, if you're not in a boardroom, or if you're not a heavy shareholder of Twitter, if you're just a user and you don't care anything about, the stuff that's going on with Elon and the fact that he's flaking out on this deal, it sucks.
Right.
And it's not a and it's not an easy thing to swallow. Because for lack of a better term, the platform has been successful the way it's been successful for a reason. And that's because you have a variety of people that have made the platform into this very organic ecosystem of thoughts and ideas and, you know, just all sorts of things going on, you know? So I know, in my capacity on there, you know, for those of you that have, you know, that know, that follow me outside, you know, on Twitter, outside of the podcast, you know, I'm a writer, I'm a sports writer. You know, I write, cover HBCU athletics, bands and HBCU culture. And, you know, for HBCUs, Twitter's been a godsend because it's really expanded the brands of everybody from football teams to bands to other things in the culture. And, you know, we don't want platforms like that to go the way of the dodo. You know what I'm saying? Because that is really, you know, it's been an effective tool for getting the words out there for HBCU bands, you know, or HBCU programs, HBCU culture. So, you know, there are certain aspects where there are people going to be collateral damage, so to speak, in terms of whether things happen on Twitter in a negative fashion or not. You know, so, I mean, but what can you do?
Right, right. I mean, like you said, I mean, Twitter can be a cesspool of just terrible stuff. I don't know. It can just be a cluster at times, right? Yes. It could be. In fact, I'm actually taking a fast from social media this month just to get away from it all, just kind of reset. But like you said, like I use Twitter a lot. I got I'm also a writer, as most of you probably know. I write for Digital Trends and IGN, and I got the IGN job because of Twitter. I randomly saw one of the editors, senior editors, post about a freelance position. I was like, oh, what about me? And then I got it, right? So it's like you said, it's also how we promote the Black Techies. It's how you, I mean, it's a very useful platform if you know how to use it. I mean, that's almost any platform. Like YouTube has, people have literally made their entire careers on YouTube. Popular tech YouTubers, MKBHD, right? Soldier Knows Best. Kevin the Tech Ninja, we had them on the show a few years back, right? I'm trying to get them back on the show. but like, the problem is that when you have these large platforms, these large social media platforms, you're always going to be beholden to whatever that platform, like if they change anything, like if YouTube changes its algorithm, now you gotta somehow change your content to fit YouTube's algorithm. Same thing on Twitter. If there's a new trend on Twitter, or you have to kind of adjust to things. It might not be as fluid on Twitter as it is on YouTube, but still, I mean, you have to know how to use Twitter's tools for engagement and all that kind of stuff. But so it can be a very useful platform to get out your message, to promote your business and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't know. It's gonna. I think it's gonna be a crap show, but we'll see.
Well, real quick, we have to do an ad break for our overlords at HBCU Digital Network. Sorry, overlords. We got an ad coming up. So stay tuned. We're gonna talk about some more topics, probably including Elon's continued flake out on Twitter, but there's some other things that we're going to be talking about as well. Stay tuned.
Yeah, baby, you know what time it is. Now let's get it started.
Are you kidding me? Unreal!
While our HBCUs are mostly known for an academic rigor, community, they also know how to turn up.
Does he have it? Yes, he does!
All right, and we are back. Now, full disclosure, those of us that are part of the Black Techies, you know, all of us got together, you know, I think a couple of months ago, you know, offline while we're having one of our planning sessions, and, you know, the topic of the Steam Deck, you know, came up. And of course, everybody was like, man, we're pretty excited about the Steam Deck. Have you put in your reservation for the Steam Deck? Yes, I put in my reservation for the Steam Deck. Now, Steam Decks are starting to be delivered you know, well, to some people, depending on the quarter that you signed up in. And the reviews have been kind of all over the spectrum. Some people have really, really enjoyed the fact that the stream, you know, the Stream Deck has given them the flexibility to really download games and to just take their AAA libraries and stuff on the fly. Other folks ain't sold. And, you know, as somebody that has a reservation that still hasn't gotten there yet, that isn't even in position to, you know, to give my own personal evaluation, hands-on evaluation of Stream Deck, it's kind of rough, you know, sitting on the sidelines, you know, seeing, you know, evaluations that are all over the place. I know we had talked about the Stream Deck a couple of months ago on the podcast and how excited we were in terms of the change it, you know, it represented to folks that are PC gamers and gamers on the go. And, you know, Dave, do you think that there's still, you know, that type of excitement around the platform and around platforms like it?
So funny you used to say that. I literally wrote a whole article on Digital Trends about this. I recorded a Just Processing episode, or I think I renamed it Short Black and Techie. So you can, if you're subscribed, you can go back and look and listen to that. But basically I wrote how it's changing. So on the positive side, you know, like you said, like the ability to take your AAA games with you, like on a an officially sanctioned and created Valve platform, like that's a huge thing. One of the articles on The Verge was like the title was "The Steam Deck is Changing How I Buy Games," and they were saying that normally what they would do was they would buy games on the Switch. Like if it was cross platform, they would try to get it on the Switch because you can take the Switch with you, or you could dock it and play it on a TV. Right? That's why it's called the Switch. But like, the Switch is a great platform, but it's not that powerful. The Steam Deck, on the other hand, is more powerful, more power hungry, and it has worse battery life. But it's more powerful, and you can generally get a better experience on the Steam Deck than you can on the Switch. So they were saying that now they're starting to buy games on the Steam Deck just simply because, like, it's not as convenient as the Switch. Like for example, docking it, you can connect the Steam Deck to a monitor or a TV and connect a keyboard and mouse and use it like a regular PC, but it's not as easy. With the Switch, you literally just plop it into place, right? But so I don't know. I've seen a lot of hype and a lot of pleased customers. I mean, I've, like you said, the reviews are kind of mid-tiers. Like I think most of the reviews were like, when it works, oh, it's like the best experience ever, right? But then there were still some quirks, besides some of the performance issues. Now, I think Valve has issued a bunch of updates since it first came out, so some of those might be ironed out. And also, you can install Windows on it, so you could just use it like a Windows. That was the other thing. So you can install Windows on it, and now you have a portable Windows computer, full Windows, which means not only can you install, use Steam, right? You can use the Epic Game Store. You can use the Ubisoft Store. You can do homebrew. You can do emulators. I'm not going to say how to do that, but you can use emulators.
Do I have to do a disclaimer for you, dude? you're the lone guy that I wouldn't expect for me to have to do a disclaimer for.
See, now, well, technically, emulators aren't illegal. It's the ROMs that you can get that can put you in hot water if you don't get them from legit sources. But emulators are perfectly legal. In fact, I just saw a Linus Tech Tip video where they emulated the Switch on the Steam Deck. Ha! See? but they did it through legal means. Like, everything they did was legal, right? But they were using their actual games, not like downloaded ROMs, whatever. But I think I like the Steam Deck. I don't think I can justify it at the moment, buying one at the moment. But I like it. I think it represents the I won't say the future of PC gaming, but like it's, I read a post where someone said like the Steam Deck was their first PC or their first gaming PC, right? Imagine if instead of building a $1,000 gaming PC or buying one, you just bought a Steam Deck for $300 or however much it is. And like, and then it's all in one. You don't have to worry about all the other stuff that goes into PC building, and you still get a full PC, right? And you can take it with you.
Yeah,
so I see a lot of upside.
Yeah, once you started talking about homebrews and jailbreaking systems, I had to create the banner for you.
Yeah.
So, I tend to agree with that. And I mean, there's so many really good competitors in the space. I mean, you've got the one X player, one S, you know, that's Terabyte. You also got the Nintendo Switch that, you know, you mentioned. The Aya Neo is a really good competitor in the space.
GPD Win.
And I think the big thing with a lot of these is particularly the ones that runs, you know, that are able to run Windows and other platforms, is that you have the versatility to run multiple OSs on those platforms. So, you know, particularly with the One X player and the Aya Neo, you can run Windows, but if you got an enterprising dude that isn't really happy with Windows, you can load your own operating system on there. You can load Linux. You can load, you can load Arch Gerudo on there. You can load a ton of things and still have a really good gaming experience. And I think the other thing that's really interesting about, you know, Steam Deck and those other things that are, you know, in the space is that you don't necessarily have to load those things natively. You can share. I mean, with the way cloud infrastructure is now in terms of gaming, GeForce Now, you know.
Yeah, you know, I totally forgot about the streaming stuff.
Shadow, you know, which is, you know, my personal fave. You know, I'm not going to say I'm going to buy stock in the company, but I really enjoy the product. You know, there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of possibilities in terms of, you know, these platforms giving gamers a new level of flexibility in terms of, you know, just being able to take those experiences with them. Now, the downside of it is that, you got to have some scratch to buy some of these games, and you have to justify being able to buy it. Like you said, I can't justify, you know, giving up $500, $600, $700 right now for a Steam Deck, you know, or for any of these platforms, because they're higher end platforms, and, you know, they are a substantial investment. And if something happens where, you know, the market gets turned on its head and, you know, the portability factor for these things, you know, doesn't become novel anymore, then, you know, you've got expensive paperweight, and it's not cool to have an expensive paperweight. We've all been there, you know. So
mind if I correlate this to another thing? So all right, so you know how obviously during COVID, right, people were getting used to be able to work from home or work from anywhere, right? So I wonder if the fact that people are enjoying being able to move around and travel and be mobile is going to increase sales for stuff like the Steam Deck, like, right? Instead of just sitting in front of a monitor or sitting in front of a TV with a console, right? I can just buy a Steam Deck and I can play wherever I want. I mean, that's, you know, that was kind of the whole thing with the Switch. But since the Steam Deck is more powerful than the Switch, and now I'm not just playing, you know, Mario or, you know, Nintendo game. Now I'm playing the entire Steam library on there, right? So I don't know. I wonder if this is going to kind of shift gaming in a somewhat different direction as far as being more mobile, especially with the cloud streaming becoming a little bit more prevalent now, especially with Microsoft kind of promoting it a little bit more. Maybe we can talk about that afterwards. But I don't know. I just wonder if there's going to be an inflection point where people are going to prize mobility over having a standalone console or a PC that just stands there and doesn't move. I don't know. I don't think, I mean, it might not happen, but I kind of see, especially after COVID, I just kind of see people really enjoying being able to move around and not just stay in one spot to do something.
I agree. But I think there's always going to be, how can I put this? I think there's always going to be a need for a machine or a platform that you can just go and sit down to.
Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be those people, right?
Yeah. Right. And I mean, and that goes beyond just work. That goes,
yeah, I mean, particularly, I'm one of those people.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, even, you know, in our setups where, you know, you might have a laptop setup, you know, like I know my space, I got an Apple, you know, M1 setup behind me for work, you know, as well as a Linux box. And, you know, what I'm broadcasting on now, which is a Windows laptop. And, you know, I still look at myself, it's like, man, yeah, I need a small form factor platform or something, you know, just so I don't, you know, I'm not reliant on my netbooks or my laptops all the time. So, you know, those sorts of things are always going to be needed, particularly if, you know, you have older generation folks that are not really too keen on the mobility thing. You know, the mobility thing is, you know, increases more with generational use. So, you know, the more, you know, the younger the generations go, or the newer the generations are, you know, flexibility and mobility, you know, are going to be really attractive in terms of just being able to do normal things. Now, more specialized things, that's something else, you know, and that's how, you know, that's how the appeal of certain companies that specialize in specialized ecosystems and platforms, like Apple, for example. You know, you got your MacBooks and your MacBook Pros, but folks are buying the Studio, and Studio stationary, and Studio is, you know, I don't think I'm willing to give up my daughter Kindle for a Studio just yet. You know, so it's you know, those sorts of things are, there's always an appeal for them because they're, you know, depending on the maker or the, you know, manufacturer of these things, they've created a market for it. In Apple's case, you know, the ecosystem is unique. So it's not something that is going to go away regardless of whether you have a mobile platform or you have something that's more dedicated to specialized use. So, I mean, it's a real, you know, it's really hard to predict where the market goes when it comes to that, because you know, more and more now you're being able to do more sophisticated things on smaller platforms. You know, whether it's tablets, whether it's phones, whether it's laptops. You know, laptops are even getting, you know, are getting smaller, but you still have even a delineation in terms of what you use. Some people, you know, are happy with having a cloud-based laptop where, you know, they don't have to worry about any sort of upgrades or anything, and everything is on the cloud. So those sorts of things, you know, it keeps it really interesting to see where the market, you know, where certain markets go in terms of how, you know, what customers adjust to and how customers, you know, perceive those things going. And, you know, gaming is a perfect example of it. You know, I think folks that were watching the podcast, you know, a couple of years back, I think we did a podcast on Stadia and the advent of cloud gaming. And folks, I remember that podcast because I was one of those, you know, gullible people that were super excited about Stadia coming out. And, you know, it came out, and Google, you know, what they normally do, you know, they'll start on a project hot and heavy, and then they get bored. And then,
or at least they, you know, don't next implement it. I don't know. Which, you know, it's funny now that we're talking about Stadia. So, like, it's sad because Stadia itself is actually really good. Like, I've used Stadia before. Like, the app, like, when you compare Stadia with Xbox game streaming and like GeForce Now, it actually compares pretty favorably as far as like latency and input lag and all that kind of stuff. It's actually really good. But I think the way they marketed it as being like a replacement for like a console, like, or a PC, I think that's might have been what kind of was kind of iffy for some people. Like, do I want to make this my only machine? At least for now, I don't think that's a good sell. They probably should have done it, made it like a Xbox Game Pass where you had a you pay Stadia for Stadia Pro and you get all these games you can play in the cloud. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Paying $60 for a cloud-based game, I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, I kind of feel the same way about, you know, Amazon's offering Amazon Luna.
Oh yeah, I forgot about Luna.
Luna stick. You know, Amazon's sticking with it. And
have you used it?
Yeah, I've used it, and it's pretty smooth. Yeah, I've used it. It's pretty smooth, but the caveat is that if you don't have the, you know, the native hardware that comes with it, like the controller and stuff like that. Like, you know, when I used it, I used my phone, you know, cause you have an app that you can use a phone for controller. And that is an experience that I would not wish on my worst enemy in terms of using it.
Because is it like the Stadia remote where it connects? I think this, cause the Stadia remote connects to Wi-Fi and then it connects separately to the Stadia servers versus connecting to your computer or whatever you're using.
Yeah, it works the same way. So like if you have a Luna controller, it's the same premise. You connect the controller to Wi-Fi and, you know, it's separate from, you know, what you connect in with your Fire Stick. So, and that's the thing. It's like, if you have a Fire Stick, Fire Cube, or any of that, you know, of that particular thing in terms of infrastructure, you can use it. And you can also use it on PC. So it's, again, it's one of those things where, yeah, I mean, there's some potential, but, you know, the flip side of that is that, you know, certain, you know, AAA manufacturers have channels on there, like, for example, Ubisoft has its own channel and where you can get all their games, but the games are a grip. And it's like, do I really want to pay for this, you know, and only be able to play it, you know, in the cloud? Or, you know, what's the premise of doing that as opposed to just going the traditional route through Steam or going the traditional route with a, you know, and digitally purchasing the game, you know, for your computer? So, you know, I think there's still a good deal of growth that could happen, you know, in terms of cloud gaming. Like I said earlier, I think even though Shadow is kind of niche to a lot of people, Shadow gaming is, I mean, it's ridiculously good. If you're close to a data center, if you got really good internet connectivity, to me, that is one of the best services out there, them and GeForce Now. And I mean,
yeah, GeForce Now is really good. Like, I absolutely pay for it. The only thing that doesn't work that well with GeForce Now, ironically, is Ubisoft. So you can connect your Ubisoft account and you can play your Ubisoft games from there. So I was playing The Division 2. I was just seeing how the experience, and it wasn't great. Like, it was laggy. It kept stuttering and stuff. But like, if you play Steam games, it's fine. Right? I was playing Cyberpunk. It was fine. So I'm going to blame Ubisoft on that one. But
I mean, it's definitely, you know, again, it's one of those things where depending on what you want, my girlfriend is really funny. Depending on what you want, it's something that, those experiences, whether you're playing on a Stadia or Shadow or any number of the cloud solutions in terms of gaming, it really depends on, you know, the gamer. You know, serious gamers, dieharders, or purists, as I like to call them, they are not going to really look kindly on things like Stadia, simply because it's like, well, I don't have a platform to play it on. You know, and same thing can be said for console heads. You know, the console heads are like, yeah, it's not a console, I'm not going to touch it. You know, so.
Well, I mean, there is something to having like physical hardware to run the game on. You don't have to worry about internet latency. Maybe your internet sucks where you are, right? You don't want to depend on the internet to play games. I mean, so I, you know, on some, like you said, there's always going to be a market for those people who don't or maybe can't, right? We still have a lot of inequality when it comes to broadband access, right? Some people just can't. Like, what you, as good as Starlink is, maybe. I'm not going to try. I'm probably not going to try to run
I'm good on Starlink, dude.
Right. I, you know, I'm probably not going to try to run, you know, cloud gaming on a, through a satellite network, right? Even the 5G broadband networks that Verizon and T-Mobile are trying to roll out, like that, like the, I'm sure you've seen the commercials, right? They're trying to advertise you can replace your, you know, your wired connection or whatever with a 5G connection. I'm like, no, I like my Fios. I like my one gig Fios.
Yeah, and I, and you know what? I'm not even going to run the risk of going down that route. I mean, and that's not to say T-Mobile doesn't have won't have a good product, because, you know, I mean, I tried. I mean, T-Mobile, if you remember back in the day, they merged with a company, and I forgot the name of the company, that, you know, was one of the real, you know, one of the really early players in streaming television, and you know, and you know. I think they were, you know, they were right there prior, you know, when YouTube television was coming out. They were one of the same folks, and I had their service, but I can't remember the name of the service. I know that T-Mobile bought their service and it became part of their, you know, their streaming TV infrastructure. And it, the fact that I have it, I had it, and it, the name escapes me, is pretty sad all the way around. But it, I mean, it was a really, really, really good deal if you had, you know, the, you know, the normal, if you had a good internet connection, and, you know, you were at a spot that got the coverage, you know what I'm saying? So, it, and I mean, that, you know, that's kind of what it boils down to, you know, with some of the streaming gaming services. It's one of those things where you, I mean, it's a haves and have nots type of deal now. If you're on the Eastern Seaboard, Western Seaboard, in the South, you know, you're right there by some of the fastest, you know, internet connectivity in the world. So yeah, you can pretty much do whatever. Yeah. You know, data centers there are just, you know, you can pretty much do anything. If you're in the Midwest, you know, outside of some place like Chicago, even though Chicago's a pretty big hub, but if you're like in the Plain States or Midwest or Southwest, you're hurting. And it's like, it's, you know, and it's kind of rough because you don't, you know, that says more about, you know, where our infrastructure is at in terms of that sort of connectivity more than any capability. So, you know, I mean, I think the market is going to be, is always going to be affected by things like that until, you know, those things even out and normalize.
So it's funny you say that, because that's that that was the pitch that Verizon and T-Mobile made when they were like, we're going to roll out 5G broadband, right? They were like, well, like, in fact, when they were bidding for the spectrum, the FCC said they could only get it if they were going to deploy it to like rural area, rural areas, right? So the people who actually need fast broadband. And so I mean, theoretically, if they build out more towers in those areas and roll out 5G, that could be a legitimate way for people to get fast broadband. I mean, it's not wired, but I mean, it's wireless is a lot easier to roll out than wired. Yeah. I mean, imagine trying to roll out a bunch of fiber everywhere. So
yeah, and I think that's the appeal of the T-Mobile product in terms of, you know, bringing that level of connectivity in terms of 5G. Broadband connectivity in the home, you know, and I think if it's priced the right way, you know, it could be really successful because it could be a cheaper alternative, you know, to what you would normally get with, you know, fiber, fiber solutions like Fios or Google Fiber or a number of other competitors out there. We are up against another break. And when we come back, we are going to talk about, you know, some of our shows, favorite things that are coming out. Some things really came to mind in terms of that. So yeah, we will be right back. Check out this ad for the HBCU Experience Band Edition. We'll be right back.
The first ever HBCU Band Anthology, The HBCU Experience. The HBCU Band Alumni Edition is a collection of stories written by prominent HBCU Band alumni throughout the world. HBCU Band alumni who are doing great things in their careers, businesses, and communities nationally and internationally. The authors share their stories and experiences of how being a HBCU band member has molded them into the people they are today. Purchase your copy today and support the HBCU Experience, the HBCU Band Alumni Edition at Amazon.com.
And we're back. Again, I can't stress enough how much fun it was for both myself and Dave to be a part of the initial HBCU Experience Band Edition project. We really didn't know who was writing or who was on the project until, you know, really, really late into the project. And when we found out it was some really cool, you know, some of our colleagues and some other really cool folks, we were really, really excited about it. So it is imperative, you know, that you guys support the second edition of this book. You know, like I said, it's coming out. And, you know, in our world, if you're familiar with, you know, HBC Bandom, some of the folks that are on it are some heavy hitters, real heavy hitters, famous Hall of Fame directors, you know, some Grammy award-winning artists that are part of the book. Check it out. It's a really good read. And it is also available now on Amazon and your other platforms where you buy books. Shout out to Dr. Ashley Little, Dr. Christy Walker, you know, AKA the boss lady. they've been really instrumental in making the first two projects come together. So yeah, big, big shout out to those guys. Now that the plug is out of the way, shameless plug, we are, you know, we're going to finish up the show with doing some other fun stuff. And essentially just talking about some of the shows we've been kind of digesting, you know, on this show, you know, on this broadcast, on this podcast, we talk about a bunch of stuff in terms of shows. Today, I'm on my sci-fi kick, so I'm going to be talking about some of the sci-fi shows that I've been watching and some of the stuff that I'm looking forward to that's coming up. You know, I'll leave House of the Dragon until last because that's coming up in August. And for those of you guys that were following Game of Thrones and stuff, you know, when the series was out originally, the prequel to it, which is already in the books, was some pretty, pretty brutal stuff. So I'm looking forward to seeing what HBCU does with the book, you know, how they handle the prequel. And like I said, there's been a lot of really good stuff on TV, on not television, but on cable. Whether it's Amazon, whether it's, you know, been, you know, Apple TV. I'm really impressed with what I've seen on there. You know, For All Mankind's been my hook for the entire summer. You know, that alternate history space race joint is pretty nice, you know. Dave, what are some of the things you've been watching? You've been checking out?
So, funny you used to say that. So just last night, we saw Thor: Love and Thunder.
no spoilers, dude. I haven't seen
it yet. No, I know. Don't worry. I will not spoil.
No spoilers. I'll be seeing it tomorrow, man. I had thrust kicked somebody with a spoiler, dude.
Really, someone already spoiled something?
No. Oh. I'm just that's how I treat people that spoil. I've been accused of it before, and I understand now because it's like, stop spoiling the flick. I'm getting ready to go see it.
when people have no chill though, like it'll come out and then like the day after people's like just talking about it. I'm like, look, can you wait until like we wait past the weekend at least? No, so I'll say I liked it better than Thor Ragnarok personally. I like Thor Ragnarok, but I think some of the tendency of like, so if you saw Thor Ragnarok, you know, it had Taika Waititi's brand of humor and stuff like that, right? It was a lot more humor in that one than the original Thor and the Dark World. Some people don't like that. Like my wife, for example, she actually likes the tone, the serious tone of like the original two movies. So some people don't necessarily like Taika Waititi's humor because a lot of times, like it'll be like a serious scene, right? But then like it'll be interrupted with like a joke or something, and it's like it just feels off. But I don't know. I feel like there's still a lot of humor because it's Taika Waititi, right? It's still a lot of humor in Love and Thunder. But I thought they did it better personally. So I think it was maybe a better movie overall. And it had a good bit of like touching moments. It's called Love for a reason. So like there were, especially towards the end, there was a few touching. I was like, you almost get me. But I thought it was done very well. The acting, Christian Bale as Gore the God Butcher.
I'm looking forward to seeing that.
He is definitely one of the better Marvel villains in my opinion. I would recommend it.
I'll tell you a Marvel film that I was a little bit disappointed in, and you know where I'm about to go. And that's I won't say it was bad, but the Doctor Strange sequel, Multiverse of Madness,
I didn't like it as much as I wanted to.
It wasn't bad, but you had to really, really, really be up on the comic in order to get a lot of stuff that was talked about into it. You know, I think the funniest thing about it was their portrayal of the Illuminati and the way they went out. It was just like the wackest version of the thing compared to the comic, you know. It was comical, and I understand what they were trying to do with it. But at the same time, if you're, like I said, if you're a casual Marvel fan and you're just, you know, really catching up on the movies, you really couldn't get the continuity of the movie. If you get what I'm saying, you know, you had to know, you know, some of the ins and outs of the Doctor Strange characters, some of the relationships between Strange, you know, and the Scarlet Witch, WandaVision, you know. And I mean, they could have did a better job. And I'm not going to blame Marvel because everything they put out can't be a banger. You know, they're allowed to slip up one time here and there. You know, if this was an animated, you know, movie or something like that, you know, I'd probably be a little bit more critical. You know, same thing with DC. DC's the same way. You know, we know they do live flicks and, you know, we expect them to be kind of subpar, but when they do animated movies, you know, the animated movies are, their head and shoulders above everything, top tier. So, but yeah, I mean, as far as some of the other things I've been watching, For All Mankind, I really, really, really dig that show.
That's on Apple TV, right?
You know, it's on Apple TV. And for those folks that aren't familiar with it, For All Mankind is an alternative history look at the space race. And the first two, you know, the first couple of seasons, you know, the first couple of seasons focus on the Cold War, you know, between Russia and America. And in this, you know, in this timeline, you know, the Russians beat America to the moon, you know. And it's really, I mean, it's really, really cool stuff. This third season has really focused on the race for Mars. And it's focused on, you know, those same Cold War rivalries going on and a private entity that's entered into the race. It's, you know, it's a really, really smart take on, you know, the sci-fi genre in terms of looking at how history could have gone as opposed to how it did, you know, some of the technology that's been, that could have been developed, and the science behind, you know, space industry, space flight, the whole nine is really, really cool stuff. It's, you know, it's a very intelligently done sci-fi, you know, sci-fi series. And it's something that, you know, if you're looking for something less sophisticated, don't watch this, because you're not going to like it. But if you're looking for something that's pretty sophisticated, that is very plausible. You know, it's a very, very good show. It's a really good show. You know.
All right. I'll swing in the other direction, kind of, sort of. So I like to watch anime, and I'll watch some of it with my daughter, because she also likes anime, so it's kind of a way for us to bond and all that. But the my wife is not into anime, right? But
the one
that she will watch is called Spy Family. That's like that new hotness out right now, is Spy Family. That show is amazing. That show is hilarious. So the gist is that so there's this family of, you know, there's the husband, the wife, and the kid, but they're a family because they're not a family because they legitimately like love each other, brother. So like the guy is secretly a spy family, mm-hmm. And the woman is secretly an assassin, and the girl inexplicably has psychic powers. He can read people's minds, and so which is weird, right? But it works. But like they all have their different reasons for wanting to be a family. I won't kind of spoil everything, but it's actually a great family show to watch. I mean, it's you see a lot of things from the perspective of the girl, because she can read their minds. She knows that you like, she knows the man is really a spy, and she knows that the woman is really an assassin. But because she's a little girl and she wants that family, she doesn't say anything. Like, she wants to keep her family together, because, you know, she wants a mommy and daddy, right? And so it's a kind of heartwarming, honestly. It's very cute. Like, she's a very cute girl, kind of annoying at times, but that kind of ties into her charm, I guess. But I would highly recommend Spy Family if you have not seen it. It's on right now, I think it's just on Crunchyroll. So I mean, if you're not into like sub anime, sorry. So you're gonna have to read the subtitles.
Well, on that note, Crunchyroll and Funimation have merged. Yep. So it's Crunchymation, or
didn't one, you know, bought by Sony?
Yeah, they were both bought by Sony. So, yeah, and you know, we speaking of anime, you know, I've been catching up on my Legend of the Galactic Heroes anime. On
where's that at?
that's on Crunchyroll and Funimation.
Oh, okay.
It's well, there are two versions. There's the old version that was done in, I believe, the early 1980s. And the modern version, you know, and it's not the typical mecha based, you know, space anime. It's really, again, it's a very intelligently done, you know, just really developing storyline type of show, where, you know, you've got two empires, you got Free Earth Alliance, and you've got the, you know, the Galactic Empire, and I think they modeled it off of, I think they used some World War II motifs, mm-hmm. To model it, because I know the Empire is kind of German in nature, and the Free Alliance is United States in nature, you know, and some other players in it, and it's really, like I said, it's really, really, really well done. You know, it's one big giant space drama, and it's really cool, you know, plus, you know, on top of that, they got, you know, one of my favorite animes of all time, Star Blazers, on that platform. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the modern version, I mean, the fact that they're really, they're getting ready to release another one, you know, like another movie, I think that's being released in October. I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to Bleach.
That's right. The Thousand Year War.
The Thousand Year Blood Art. That is going to be
that I haven't watched Grease in years.
Yeah. You are a fan of Shonen Jump and you're a fan of Bleach and you've read the manga, you cannot miss this. This is really, I'm really interested in seeing how they translate from the manga, because the manga was ridiculous. Yeah, it was really, yeah, really well done. How they translate all of that stuff, you know, into a television show designed for American audiences. And that is really, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing that. It's, you know, I mean, the fall's going to have some pretty nice, my time's going to be occupied between, between trips and covering stuff for HBCU Digital Network and, you know, catching up my shows on the weekend, man. I'm going to be, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to, I'm going to have to, you know, my on-demand platform is going to get a lot of work. A lot of work. So
it's so many shows to watch, so little time. So before we end, I will say we're going to talk about this Cannon Busters. We have to talk about Cannon Busters eventually because it's an all black anime. We got to talk about the all black anime on the black podcast. We have to talk about it.
Well, we've been trying to do that for the last year since Cannon Busters came out. We were supposed to have Roberto on the show. Roberto, you know, and Dom, you know, have, you know, they're part of our rotation that has been really heavy in that and into that anime as well. So whenever we have that conversation, they have got to be present in the rotation to have that combo.
No, I'm fine with that. But one day we gotta talk about Cannon Busters. I need to rewatch it now. But yeah, we need to talk about it because I think it's one of those things that you gotta. And I don't think it was hyped up as much as it should have been, but that's me.
Well, you guys heard it here first. Don't be surprised if you see an all anime episode of the Black Techies podcast.
We haven't had one already, honestly. Yes. But yeah.
Yes. Yeah, because we've been talking about having one and we haven't had one. So yeah, don't be surprised if you see that, you know, come up on the descriptions in one of our future podcasts. You know, all of us that are part of the podcast, part of rotation, are pretty heavy in anime. So that will be probably the next I won't say non-tech episode because I'm, you know, the last couple of episodes have been really non-tech. Particularly this last episode, for our producers, you know, for HBCU Digital Network, the F-bombs that were dropped on the previous podcast are not the normal fare in terms of our family-friendly format. So we will always put out a disclaimer prior to the show, prior if we have another show like that where, you know, some norms are going to be crossed. So, you know, for parents and you know, viewers with weak constitutions, you won't have to worry about that anymore. You'll always have a disclaimer put out. But I think that's the end of our show for today. And again, I wanted to, you know, really extend a big thank you for, you know, everybody that's been following the podcast. You know, we've been, you know, me and Dave have been doing this thing for what now, almost four years now.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Dave approached me about, you know, doing the podcast, and I was really super excited about doing it. And it's really grown. I know Dave is looking around the corner for his food. So
I'm looking at my daughter. You peeking out?
You know, I know me personally, and I know I can speak for Dave in this regard, and the rest of Techies. We are really, really blessed to have the following that we have, you know, for the podcast. You know, we get a chance to talk about stuff that is really, you know, relevant and cover space that isn't covered, you know, that isn't really represented, you know, out there in the medium. And the fact that, you know, Dave and, you know, the rest of our other, you know, our other rotation mates have been doing the thing and we've, you know, gathered the following that we have the last couple of years has really been amazing. And, you know, thank you guys. For those folks that want to support the Black Techies, join our Discord
and Patreon.
Join join our Patreon. Please, we need cash for sponsors. join our Patreon. And
websites ain't free.
No, they're not. Not in the slightest. And if you want to find out more insider info about our future podcasts, join our Facebook group, the Black Techie Collective. We post all sorts of other different types of content in there, all sorts of interesting tidbits that go, you know, that deal with tech, HBCU, Black folks, and beyond. So join those platforms and check us out on the HBCU Digital Network, both HBCU Digital Network on their website and on the YouTube channels, and our platforms on Twitter and YouTube. You will always be able to catch our show on those platforms. Again, thank you guys very much. You know, for, you know, Leader Emeritus Dave Matthews, I am Herbert Seward, and this has been the Black Techies Podcast on HBCU Digital Network. Peace out, y'all. Hail Wakanda.
Hail Wakanda.